dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. The war for the free world, I think, is on the minds of a lot of people here. You hear some of them in the background attending the Conservative Political Action Conference 2020. We're here broadcasting from Radio Row and visiting with a number of people who are part of this program, or at least attending in the hopes that they can help the conservative movement and the country in this critical year make the right sorts of decisions. I'm very pleased that we have with us as our first guest a man who is working a portfolio that's not typically front and center in these conversations, but that of course is relevant to the security of our country. It's relevant to specifically the health of our people. His name is Andrew Mangione. He is a senior vice president at Association of Mature American Citizens, AMAC. He is in charge of AMAC's action program, the advocacy arm, which represents some 2.1 million members. And he specializes in healthcare with a background in pharmaceutical and healthcare management. And we wanted to visit with him about two topics. First, an initiative that AMAC is involved in that could be very important to our healthcare system and the degree to which it really benefits the people of this country. And I want to talk to him a bit about the prospects for that healthcare system as what's happening now in China plays out. Andrew, it's very nice to have you with us. Welcome. Thank you for taking a few minutes to join us at Secure Freedom Radio. Tell us a bit about the specific steps that President Trump has taken to try to improve the quality of healthcare and what you at AMAC are trying to do to help him accomplish that.
The president has issued a number of executive orders with an eye towards a major discussion on healthcare reform. A specific order that he issued last year would compel hospitals to disclose their secret negotiated prices that they have with insurance companies and also the cash prices that they accept for specific procedures. The idea here is to make this information available to patients. And these would be for shoppable procedures, procedures like a knee replacement, something that's not an emergency situation. The idea here is to have this information available in a easy-to-read format so people can shop for these services much like they do everything else in their lives, like a car or
a competitive marketplace.
It's exactly right. And AMAC supports this. It's called price transparency. Unfortunately, the day after the president ordered HHS to come up with this rule, the lobby for hospitals, the American Hospital Association, sued HHS to keep all of this information private. And their argument is that this is, among other things, a First Amendment violation.
The idea of competitiveness might have something to do with this actual agenda, but what on earth are they talking about in terms of the First Amendment?
They're saying that by disclosing this information violates the First Amendment rule, but in the same breath, these prices are revealed. They show up in an explanation of benefit statements, only it's after the people have been treated and much later when people could have cost compared and shopped for a more cost-effective procedure.
In other words, when they get the bill,
yes,
there is transparency, but not so much before when they are deciding whom they're going to have as a healthcare provider. So I just want to drill down. Which First Amendment freedom? It's not freedom of religion, I don't think.
Right.
I don't think it's freedom of the press.
Right.
So is it freedom of speech?
Yes.
How on earth could that be a problem if there's something that makes it more transparent, whatever one is speaking about?
Right. AMAC has joined an amicus brief with other patient advocates in support of price transparency. And we're arguing that because this information is disclosed, ultimately, there is no First Amendment issue here.
This sounds like a very important initiative. I'm interested in it personally, and I think probably our listeners would be as well. It's a little bit outside of our wheelhouse at Secure Freedom Radio, but I hope you'll keep us abreast of developments. And I know your representative, Robert Charles, is a frequent guest on our program, and we look forward to having more information about
all of this. Let me turn to another topic, though, as a man with some experience in the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. One of our colleagues in our Committee on the Present Danger of China is Rosemary Gibson. And Rosemary has written a book called China RX, which talks about the yawning dependency of our healthcare system on China, specifically for medicines, but also for other things like sterile gloves and gowns and
masks,
for heaven's sakes. Her contention, and it's been out now for 2 years, and sadly it was not heeded. Apparently nothing has been done to ameliorate the situation in the interval. It is her contention that if China cuts us off from supplies of pharmaceuticals, generic drugs or the ingredients thereof, or gowns or gloves or masks, the healthcare system of the United States is going to come to a screeching halt in a matter of weeks. And my concern is that I think it's the case that we've been cut off already as a result of the coronavirus and the decision of the Chinese government to retain whatever they've manufactured, and they're certainly not manufacturing much at the moment. So could you give us, and I know this is not something that you're personally responsible for at the moment, but just your take on how serious this vulnerability is, and is that really in prospect now?
Well, I think that your concern is valid. I think that just given the sheer volume of medications that come out of China, and the fact that whole towns are pretty much deserted right now based on this virus, that we could be, and the process has already begun. What this does is highlight and underscore our dependence on China in a medical situation, not only for supplies, not only for drugs, but perhaps some devices as well. I don't know if the cutoff is intentional. We don't know the reason why this is happening with the virus and why it's spread, but it certainly exposes our dependence upon them in the medical arena. And I think it's approaching a serious concern, if not grave.
And again, a national security problem.
Without
doubt. Not least.
Without a doubt.
Among other reasons, because our military men and women and veterans, of course, are all similarly dependent upon these sorts of supplies. It does seem unimaginable that a country with the capabilities and power of the United States is likely to be unable to rectify this situation in the near future. And as a result, assuming, and it seems now that the administration's medical team is making it pretty clear, it is coming here. In fact, it is here a bit already, and it is beginning to spread, that this is going to constitute a very significant public health problem, if not a downright emergency. And so I'm sure that the people who are participating in AMAC are especially concerned about this because, like me, they're of a certain age, many of them, and
certainly
that vulnerability is apparently particularly acute for older Americans in the future.
Well, certainly, Frank, and I think that the president's big on transparency. He's big on transparency in healthcare from a competitive standpoint. If they approach this outbreak with the same transparency and be honest and forthright, let us know exactly what's going on, who's in charge, and I know that the administration has taken steps, but Vice President Pence in charge of information, tracking the virus, and coming up, I mean, I think we are weeks away from trials for a potential vaccine. And one thing that AMAC members do not like, they do not like to be spoken down to. They want the information on any subject, and I think it's probably the same for all of this demographic, and then they'll make a decision. So keep the information free-flowing.
It seems eminently sensible, and I hope that we will see more of it in the future. Thank you very much, Andrew Mangione, the Senior Vice President at AMAC Action, the advocacy arm of the Association of Mature American Citizens. We appreciate your time today, and we'll be speaking to somebody else right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're visiting with distinguished guests here at the Conservative Political Action Conference. There's a little ambient noise, which authenticates the fact that we are indeed at the Conservative Political Action Conference. I'm very pleased to have been introduced a short while ago by a dear friend with whom we will be speaking momentarily, Elizabeth Sabadich Wolf, to Tom van Grieken. He is a member of the Belgian Parliament in Brussels, not to be confused with the European Parliament, also in Brussels most of the time. He is the leader of the second biggest party in Belgium. It is a Flemish party. You understand its unpronounceable name means Flemish interest, And it is a conservative party, and Tom is here mingling with other conservatives to talk a bit about what he's doing there and learn perhaps how we can be of help to him. Tom, it's very nice to meet you. Welcome to America, and specifically to the conservative movement here. Give us sort of a situation report, if you would, on both what you see on the ground in your somewhat divided country, as well as what you're seeing when you look at the European Union itself.
There is a big patriotic conservative movement on the rise in Europe. We see it in tons of countries in Europe. You have Italy, you have France, you have Germany, but also in the Netherlands, Belgium, but also smaller countries like Estonia, Denmark, and so on. So you see a new division between people. I don't know if you know the guy, Guy Verhofstadt. He's a crazy guy. He wants a united European Union and wants to transfer national sovereignty to a higher level, the European Union, without any democratic support for it. Each referendum.
I wish that were only one crazy guy. I thought that was the whole agenda of the European Union.
It is the whole agenda. It's undemocratic, it's anti-democratic, and that's why the Brits left. Oh. And national sovereignty, maybe when it's in the 90s or the 80s, nobody really cared about it. Free world and so on, but as Europe, we are truly faced with mass immigration, which is a pressure for our social security, for our cultural identity, and so on. So what we see in Europe, you can also see in Belgium, where we have the same problem. The European Union is an artificial state where people are forced to live together, and they don't be able to speak to each other. And you see it, they had one big example, it's Belgium, where you have the Dutch, the Flemish in the north, and the French in the south. And it's an artificial state created, and it doesn't work that well. You might know how many days are we without a government at this moment in Belgium? Almost a year. We have the world record of having no government, more than 500 days. So that's something why it does not work. An artificial state where you force people, take away their freedom. Take away the freedom to be who they are. Take away the freedom to bring their own ideas.
So has this improved noticeably the quality of life in Belgium, that you don't have a government for almost a year now? I would think that might actually be a considerable improvement.
Yeah, you said there are two parliaments in Brussels, but actually, economic-wise, we're stable, a bit better, but because we're influenced by Germany. But the most funny thing is, of course, we are a small country, but we have seven parliaments, six governments. So we have the Senate, Chamber, Wallonian Parliament.
Everybody's in elective office,
Dutch
it sounds like.
If we had per head, like China had per head the same amount of ministers per capita, China would have 7,000 ministers. It's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous country. It's a surrealist country. So it's not really improving, not having a Belgian government, but we have functional regional parliaments, and they take the most part of it.
And speaking of regional sort of entities, your aspiration, as I understand it, is to hive off and have your own Flemish state rather than to be part of this uncomfortable union. Tell us what the prospects are for that, and does Brexit indicate that there's movement in that direction more generally?
Actually, it is. For the British, they were forced to live in an artificial state, European Union, and never ask the people. We are, 180 years ago, were forced as well to live in an artificial state. And now we see the biggest party in my country is NVA, also a conservative party, wants independence, and we are. The two biggest parties are for independence. Hmm. We're in negotiations for a new government in Flanders, also went to the king, and there we had 44% of the votes, 47% of the seats. So we're so close. Mm. So now the Belgium state is very afraid of it. And the establishment should be afraid. The establishment should be afraid in Belgium. The establishment should be afraid in the European Union, because people are fed up. They want their freedom, and they will not be changed by its state.
Let me ask you about the rap on folks like yourselves in Europe. It's that of American conservatives too, to be sure, but specifically about these various parties that are now increasingly, it seems, enjoying popular support like yours, and yet they're vilified as nationalists or supremacists or xenophobes or
racist,
bigots, haters,
whatever. You have a whole spectrum.
What would you say is, in fact, the character of these kinds of parties with whom yours is, I guess, broadly aligned, is it not?
I think it's patriotism, love for our country. They say conservatism, or even a form of national patriotism, they say it's hate, you hate other people. It's the opposite of it. It's because we as conservatives love our people. We don't hate other people for it. I say patriotism, conservatism is what a mother feels for their children. Mm-hmm. She wants to protect their, her children first and then of the neighbors, mm-hmm. but she doesn't hate the children of the neighbors. So it's actually what we stand for is love, not hate, mm-hmm. or whatever Antifa or the liberals mm-hmm. or can tell. No, it's truly love for the people.
Especially love of freedom. It yes. seems to me, and the sovereignty that enables that in yes. nation states. I very much align with this, needless to say, and commend you for championing it in the face of these kinds of attacks. We call it Americanism here, and I think that's a better term, as patriotism can be, than nationalism, because you get into nationalism and you're not so far from National Socialism. And
yeah. But there's a socialist.
There you go.
I understand one thing. If I go abroad, I never use the term nationalist because it's a very bad connotation in English language.
Right.
But for example, a head of Flanders calls himself also a nationalist. It's all something which a language culture. But in English, I will never call myself a nationalist because then you see Nazis coming up and so. It's simply potato, potato. What's in a name? We're patriots, conservatives. We love our nation and we love our people. Right. That's what we are.
Yeah. To the extent that that is contested, one of the ways in which the opponents of patriots, conservatives and the like, have turned, in addition to vilifying through naming mm-hmm. and shaming and so on, is simply silencing, using techniques like blasphemy laws or, restrictions on speech that have, anything that might offend religious feelings, I think, is the way the court in Brussels put it not so long ago with respect to our friend Sabatish Wolf. How is that playing out in your nation, and what does it mean for your ability to speak frankly to your people?
It is terrible. Often hear people complain here as conservatives, but please come to my country. All the newspapers in my country, they're all left to center left. There's no single center right newspaper, and they're all funded by the state. Now the funny thing,
No kidding.
They get an amount to have a lower cost.
State controlled media.
And I give you one example. I want during election time you can advertise in newspapers. We are forbidden to do it. Nobody wants our advertisements. Another thing, I can't, for example,
meaning the state controlled media will not take your ads.
Will not take my ads. Wow. For example, if I want to publish two books, I had to find a publisher in the Netherlands, but nobody wants to publish my book. I'm leader of the second biggest party. Another thing, for example,
on the grounds that you were saying hateful things or
hateful things.
Incitement
there
or
was,
I'll
give you one,
racism and bigotry.
Yeah, another example, it was in a good newspaper or was the intellectual side. They say there are 33 breaches in the program of my party against human rights. I said, please show me. And there was one. You're for freedom of speech without any borders. Therefore, you allow hate speech. Therefore, you breach human rights. I was like, yeah, you're kidding me now. That's completely the crazy thing. Because we want to say, in my party, we're the only party, so you can say whatever you want. You have even the freedom to insult someone. The only restriction we have is to cry out for violence. That's something which is not acceptable. But simply saying that is a reason to refuse me. Another example, to give writing articles with opinions, they refuse my articles. Mm. I once had a double interview with another European chairman of a party, and we did a double interview, and they only published
only,
one.
Only hit.
We paid for everything.
This is censorship.
It's censorship.
But I'm asking about something else, Tom. And again, we're speaking with Tom van Grieken from the Flemish Interest Party in
Belgium.
In addition to that kind of control, that kind of censorship, is it the case that you are now subjected to the force of law as well? Pursuant, for example, to the precedent in Elizabeth Sabatish Wolf's case, where she said something truthful about Muhammad mm-hmm. and was prosecuted for it in her own country, and it was validated by the European Court of Human Rights.
My party was once forbidden in 2004. We were back then the biggest party in the country with 24%.
Prohibited?
Prohibited. It's nothing. It was. It's quite unique in Europe. And because of that, people were starting getting afraid, and we got completely crushed to 5%. So I came into the head. Nobody. They looked for a child soldier. I was 27. Say, Tom, would you do it? Say, I'll do it. I believe in our ideas. And now we have 90% in opinion polls, 27 actually. Oh. So we're faced with it. But Sometimes you can use the law against your opponents. The law they create for us, for example, they often say to me, you're a racist. And when they say it, I do the following thing. Say, it's a crime to accuse somebody of racism. It's like saying, you're a thief, you're a thief. You can't say that. And I now filling complaints against people who call my party racist.
Bravo.
And that's what I should do. And I also got a judge, because we went to court, and a judge, I have it now on paper, who said, Vlaams Belang is not a racist party. It's a party who loves freedom, and it was never condemned.
Fantastic.
So let's use the law against those who made the laws to forbid us.
Wonderful. Tom van Kreeken, I hope we'll have a chance to continue this conversation.
Yes,
I appreciate what you're doing and the chance to hopefully make common cause in support of freedom, which you are a champion of in Europe, and we appreciate you so much.
Thanks for your time, and it was a real honor.
The pleasure is mine. Next up, we will speak with a fascinating woman, Dr. Roslyn Layton, about China tech threat and what it means for you, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It is a delight to say I have just met here at the Conservative Political Action Conference for the first time someone who I've been looking for all my life, I think. Her name is Roslyn Layton. Dr. Layton is a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute here in Washington, D.C., and is a professor at the University of Copenhagen, and has been working on the other side of the pond to raise alarm about something she's also very engaged in, obviously, here now, namely the China tech threat. And ChinaTechThreat.com is her website. Dr. Layton, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm saying that I've been looking for you for a long time because we need most urgently, I think, in this country, people who have competency in the tech space to talk sense to people who are doing business in the tech space and who are clearly being targeted by the Chinese Communist Party and made to be, in effect, enablers of our enemy. Give us a little short course on how you got into this and why you are now seized with the need to raise this alarm.
Well, I want to say I feel similarly. I've been looking for you all my life. I'm glad to be here with the Center for Security Policy and on your show. And this is, you know, why I started China Tech Threat, to reach people like you. And that's why we come to CPAC. So I have a background of, you know, I got my PhD in Internet Economics. I have worked for, you know, about quite a long time in with Internet technologies and the mobile industry. And I know that Huawei, going back to 2005, was stealing the technology of all their competitors, Cisco and Ericsson, Nokia and so on. You know, they would have a container just go missing. And a few months later, all of a sudden, Huawei was making products that were awfully similar to their competitors. How did that happen? So
That's the old-fashioned kind of theft.
Yeah,
and then there's, of course, the
right.
higher
so now we
tech
have,
version
yeah, we've
of
gone to the next
intellectual
level.
Property
right.
and, ripped off on the internet
right,
and so
right.
on.
So the other part is, you know, I'm driven by this part of a frustration, I think, as you are, that, you know, our security policy doesn't keep us safe. It doesn't understand cyber technologies. We have a war going on every single day in state and local government. And, you know, let's say North Korea put a bomb into Sony Pictures and broke all their movies. Well, if they take the movies out by computers, it's somehow Sony's fault. But if it had been a missile, we would have been in active war. So our, you know, there is a lack of understanding around how the Chinese are waging a war against us through IT and internet technologies. And so in my small way, what I'm just trying to bring attention to is, let's at least stop the willing participation in this
right.
with IT products that are made by Chinese-owned companies. As you well know, any company with Chinese ownership, if you put your data on that device, it's going to China,
right.
where the Chinese government can process it, it can inspect it, it can steal that data, and they are trying to get all sorts of, you know, hack into pharmaceutical company, financial company, whatever, but state government has a treasure trove of data.
They do.
You know, DMVs and Department of Courts and Children and Family Services, health departments, you name it. So we should not be putting that data on Lenovo laptops or Lexmark printers or Lenovo servers, what have you. And that's already in the National Vulnerabilities Database. If Very few people know to check that.
But that's at the federal level.
Right, at the federal level.
And the states
it
are not necessarily
the
getting the memo.
Right. No.
This is so interesting because, Dr. Layton, we've been working through the Committee on the Present Danger, China, to get the attention of state governments, executive and legislative branches, on the bigger problem of China. Our particular focus has been the degree to which, as Secretary of State Mike Pompeo warned recently, the extent to which pension funds, many of which, of course, are operated by the states, are underwriting enemy companies and thereby their activities and, of course, those of the Chinese Communist Party.
Right.
What you're talking about is a whole nother avenue of attack.
Right.
And I think the Secretary of State said it very well. He said, you are being targeted to these governors.
Right.
And he said, you personally are being targeted, your states are being targeted, your portfolios are being targeted, and your data
on purpose
is being targeted as well.
Yep.
And the data, I mean, this is such a huge problem because, of course, I think many of us have become accustomed to the idea that, well, data schmeda, you know, Google can have it, Facebook can have it, they can sell it, they can market it, the Chinese can steal it, difference does it make? So give us just some examples from your research at ChinaTechThreat.com of what a difference it does make.
Well, here's what I would say. You know, part of this is the, you know, there's a kind of stupidity almost at this. Well, let's say, why is it that China wants to target the states? Because they're vulnerable. They don't have the federal government, the federal military protecting them in the same way. We're securing the big targets. And that's exactly why China tips the
sub-targets.
Honestly,
I'm not sure we're doing all that good a job securing those either, but at least we're trying.
Right. So it is a whole, and a U.S. state is the size of a European country. They're large.
Some
it's a huge
them.
Amount of money. Yeah. So that's one part of this. The other part is, you know, again, the what drives me crazy. States are making their own internet privacy laws. You know, we're going to regulate the Googles and Facebooks down the drain. Fair enough, whatever. But then they contract willingly with the Chinese-owned vendor. You just open the door and say, please come and willingly take our data. That's what the contract says. That data can be taken to any country where Lenovo does business or what have you. So that level of stupidity is just mind-numbing.
So what are you trying to do about it?
In my report, what I actually do is I go by state, each state, what is the actual, how much money have they spent with that vendor, what have they bought, how many computers, how many, and so on. And I rank the states in terms of the risk. So, for example, California is one. Wisconsin, funny enough, has huge, you know, tens of millions of dollars over multi-year contracts that they have signed up to do. Now, I think that there's an important angle here if we talk about, which is NASPO, the National Association of State Procurement Officers. They organize a lot of these contracts for fiscal reasons because they want to spend the taxpayers' money wisely when they buy the 10,000 computers or what have you, but they're not doing a cybersecurity review. That's not what they offer. But I think the states think they do. So this is certainly a way that NASPO could step up and do that, you know, but they're not all on the same page. What I'm recommending as a report is that states review their contract. What have you signed up to? And the other part is, I think that, you know, security is worth paying for. But now, given that we understand the risks, we're also seeing the corrupt practices in China. That's the price is fake. We know that it's artificially low, right? And we're trying to get at that through the trade agreements. But the other part is, when we start to restrict these Chinese vendors, alternatives come into play. So, for example, when we banned Huawei, this has been great for Samsung. They've stepped up. Now, of course, I'd like to see American manufacturers do that. Policymakers are thinking about that. We can also be smarter about why are we putting all this citizen data online? Should we be doing some other policies? Do we need to collect all? You know, there's a saying, if you can't protect it, don't collect it.
Right.
You know.
But you're describing something that is more insidious than just what states think they're doing.
Yeah.
With the data, collecting it in the first instance and posting it. You're saying that really quite apart from whatever contract you've signed, if you have a Lenovo desktop in your system, everything on that system is being compromised?
Absolutely. It's a potential is there. Because if that is what that contract says, is that the data collected on that device can be transferred to any country where Lenovo does business. And it can be activated by law. They don't say which law, but we know that's the Chinese surveillance law is covering
but
that.
But I'm getting at sort of a hardware problem, not a software or contractual problem.
Right.
If it's on their machine, wherever that machine is, if that machine is connected to the internet, they can go in and grab it?
Yes, that's what a backdoor is. Yes.
Even encryption, even, you know.
Well, so what I'm trying to say is what I'm looking at is the contract terms.
We're dealing with people who don't respect the rule of law.
No.
They've built in
yes.
the means of collecting this information,
right.
and we're not sensitive to
right.
that. Which brings me to a topic that, I mean, in a way is relevant, of course, to Huawei. But more generally, the supply chains that we have become dependent upon, as you say, low bidders,
yes.
artificially
yeah.
low.
Yeah.
We have migrated our productive capacity to China for the purposes of producing medicines, among many other
yeah.
things. But to the extent that we have now not only created dependencies mm-hmm. on China, but unbelievably vast vulnerabilities to China.
Absolutely.
Here.
Yep.
Simply because of the products
right.
that we're now using here.
Yep.
is an extraordinary thing. And to the extent that this is something you've been documenting, I think it's a real public service, and I want to thank you for doing it.
Yep.
Huawei specifically, of course, is alarming many of us in the national security space because the prospect that allies, if not our own country, will become hooked up to this vacuum cleaner
mm-hmm.
for data,
mm-hmm.
as you say,
mm-hmm.
as well as state secrets
mm-hmm.
and control of the Internet of Things, which can be weaponized. I mean,
yeah.
it just goes
everything,
on and
sure.
on and on. What would you do, knowing what you do,
mm-hmm.
if you were president of the United States, to try to address the challenge that we're facing, both in our own country, of course, but also as leader of the free world?
So, well, first of all, I'd like to say, you know, why are we doing business with a communist country? You know, I think everyone would get the message about that. The other thing, very simply, the cost to rip and replace Huawei is not very much. If you look at European, I have another report on this. It's $7 per mobile subscriber to get Huawei out
rip
of mobile.
Rip and replace.
Yes.
Now, one of the things we've been told is once they're in, you can't get them out. Is that something
well,
that technically you've...
No, I would just
say,
well, because when you're moving from 4G to 5G, you may be doing a network swap out where all that old equipment can't be used anymore. So when a network, it will expire like a gallon of milk. So you've got to have to have new components. And as we move to 5G, the infrastructure is changing. You're going to move away from mobile towers to street poles. So the whole thing is changing out. It's not overnight, but in a staggered way.
Right.
So it actually doesn't cost that much to get rid of the Huawei, because when you go to 5G, a lot of it's software-based, and those are U.S. companies offering the software. So that's a win.
We're going to pause for just a second. We are speaking with Dr. Rosalind Layton of ChinaTechThreat.com, and we're going to continue this conversation about the challenge Huawei poses, but also more generally, how do we get the tech industry and Wall Street to be working for us, not the enemy. That more, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're here at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference 2020, which is taking place, of course, at a momentous time because epic decisions are in the offing. Most obviously with respect to who will be the next president of the United States, the next commander-in-chief, but also with respect to the kinds of policies that they will be pursuing. One of the most important of which, I believe, is China. In fact, we've done a poll at the Committee on the Present Danger of China recently that found very strong concern on the part of Americans about China. This was 1,000 likely voters who are concerned, yes, but actually, I think, even before coronavirus, very worried about what China is up to. And the more they learn about it, the more that concern is intensified. And fascinatingly enough, that's true across the board. Every demographic has this seeming sense that something is dreadfully wrong. We're speaking with Dr. Rosalind Layton, who has been doing some really vital research into exactly what it is that is wrong with respect to China. Specifically with respect to the kind of challenges that their technology industry and the Chinese Communist Party, for which it works, are representing to Americans, both in our tech sector and otherwise. And I'm fascinated by it. All of you can learn more about what Dr. Layton is up to at ChinaTechThreat.com. We've been speaking with her in the previous segment, but we're going to address a couple of things that we didn't quite get to, and I want to see if your sense is as of mine, that we need sort of some reprogramming, if I can use that expression, among the leaders of Silicon Valley. The technology industry out there, as you know, is largely staffed, it seems, by millennials and youngers who don't seem to have much concern about national security. We can discuss endlessly why that is. But even the leadership, who you'd think might know better, seem to be very comfortable, as are a lot of their employees, working for, as well as with, the Chinese Communist Party, but not with the United States Defense Department, for example. What is up with that? And is there anything in your interactions with those folks that suggests that something can be done about it?
Well, what I call it is that too much for too long, our policy, certainly from the left, it's been seized with what I call fake policy, fake concerns, you know. Whereas the real national security that can put our life in danger, like coronavirus, has not been at the forefront. My area is the internet area primarily, where we've been so seized with things like net neutrality and privacy rules and so on, and then completely disregard that, you know, we're buying technology from China, putting it in everywhere in our life, and then don't worry about that. Yes, so ever in our homes and so forth. So I like to bring people back to real threats, which can compromise your safety, your financials, your home, your national security, and stop worrying about the fake threats.
So just tease that out a little bit, because it may be obvious to people who've given some thought to this, but for the average American, for whom the Internet of Things, for example, is probably something they're not familiar with, but it sounds like it would be a cool thing to be able to manage all of your appliances remotely. Why is that a problem in terms of your data and in terms of China, for example, having access to it?
So what I would say is, first of all, let's recognize that technology and digital innovation, it has been a source of productivity for America. I mean, the wage growth that we've enjoyed has largely been about digitizing the economy. The internet, it was our invention. All of the app economy, 4G, we own 4G. It is the American contribution. As we're moving to 5G, and this is the fifth generation wireless service, we don't necessarily are going to win that the way we won 4G. So, you know, in terms of, you know, who's getting that and who, you know, I will say, I think some people get it. There are certainly companies, let's say, I know, for example, Verizon, they don't want any Chinese stuff in their network. That they realize it's too much of a risk. There are firms who'd say, look, we are getting out of China. Facebook walked away. So, you know, I wouldn't say
Facebook walked
out of China. They said we can't do business here because they cannot maintain, they can't operate their business.
Wow.
So they don't get credit for that.
They don't
get credit for it because when Mark Zuckerberg made that speech at Georgetown, everybody panned it. But they actually left. They don't do operations in China. So the people who do get Facebook in China, they have to make a VPN. They got to take a tunnel, what have you. But they are not offering Facebook China. They can't do it.
But is China getting access to Facebook data?
No, as far as I know, they are not. I mean, and that was their decision. Now, in terms of, this is an important area where the business community can play a role. I think that companies have been very short-sighted. When I went to business school, we had propaganda around, hey, outsource everything to China. They'll do the low-end stuff. We'll keep the high-end stuff. They take it all, okay? So all of the companies who thought they'd do business in China, China's eaten them. They take it over, as you know. This is what you guys know. But companies are being very short-sighted. Now, I think we can sell certain products, maybe farm products, certain analog kinds of things, but we should not be licensing American technology to our enemies. I mean, no one would dream of doing that with the USSR, saying, hey, here's a computer. Would you like to learn how to make one?
But you know what's fascinating is my study of this suggests that Deng Xiaoping, who we're told said to his Politburo in 1991, the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union is over. The Soviets lost. A new Cold War has begun between the United States and China, and we will win.
Yeah.
And his whole strategy was designed, we called it hide and bide for short, mm-hmm. his whole strategy was designed to ensure that China secured a degree of engagement that would not enable them to fall by the wayside as the Soviets did, in part because Ronald Reagan came along and said, we're going to take advantage of the fact that we aren't deeply engaged to cut off your cash flow and take you down, which he did. So we're not there now. Mm-hmm. And the question is, can we disengage? And just in your tech space, for example, let alone medicines and, you know, rare earth minerals and stuff, do we now have, you said rip and replace, I think, yeah, in connection, yeah, with Huawei, do, yeah, we have that capacity now to produce the hardware, mm-hmm, as well as, of course, the software that would enable us to have domestic, secure alternatives to these, right, Chinese enemy, right, operations?
So I would say it's going to it depends on the industry and the company, but we need to go in that direction because this will not be easier in 5 years. We may not have a chance, so we have to get started however we can. Certainly, I think that at least I'm grateful our president, we've done the minimum, you know, in terms of we know Huawei and ZTE, no Huawei network equipment, and that's also FCC has stepped up. So, you know, no taxpayer subsidies are used on this. That's great, mm-hmm, right?
But, it's a start.
Right. But the other issues, you know, there's a lot more strategic things around 5G, for example. Do we have the proper spectrum? There's a big vote at the FCC today to get the C-band in play. I mean, we had to fight to do that because now our 4G era, that's fine. We won that. That's great. But the new area, which is Internet of Things, it'll be quantum computing, AI, robotics, and so on, there's no necessary advantage that we have. So I'm less worried about ripping out the old stuff. That's over with now. It's what are we going to do in the future? What's our value proposition? Mm-hmm. Now, I think we have the ingenuity, we have the entrepreneurial, the values, we have an amazing country that can surge and work together. But we also have to win the hearts and minds. Mm-hmm. I think when you bring it up to a lot of ordinary Americans, they're on board with it. They're willing to you say, look, we're getting out of China, we're going to pivot to our hemisphere, we're going to work with Europe, what have you. We're not going to be in bed with China anymore. I think a lot of people would be on board with that. The problem is we have semiconductor industry, Qualcomm, who made this great technology. They're the ones fighting this, the ones who don't want to take the short-term hit for their profits.
Right.
And so this is
see, I had a conversation with one of their senior executives just the other day. They don't seem to see that they too...
They will render themselves redundant.
Will wind up in exactly the same place that so many other, the Motorolas, for example, have
here's something the millennials can do if they care so much. I mean, if they, apparently it's all driven by emotion and being good and so on, sustainable,
feeling
whatever.
Good.
Funnel that feeling into making America, you know, to caring about America and our livelihood and our future, and not siding with the dictators who put the Muslims in the prisons and so on.
This is so vital and so overarching a problem. It's something that I have to say about CPAC is heartening because there are large numbers of young people in this audience, and they are a sign that all is not lost.
Yeah.
But I think it starts with understanding that there is something special and indeed necessary and unique about the American experiment. And if you don't have that as sort of your foundation, I'm not sure that you get the rest of it, and you will wind up probably speaking Chinese and not only buying their products but living under their dominion. We have to leave it at that. Dr. Rosalind Layton, I thank you so much for this work and for this first conversation of what I hope will be many. I appreciate what you're doing at ChinaTechThreat.com. I hope you'll come back to us frequently with
updates.
Absolutely.
Thank
you. God bless you. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.